What is wrong with Western media?
They can't quit Hamas, right? They just can't quit them.
Yeah. There's a mind. It's a mind virus. What is it?
The first explanation is they're just f***ing anti-Semites, right? Which is definitely true of some of them. I mean, if you want a picture of a Hamas militant off of Getty Images, you have to go back 15 years because they censor every image that comes out of Gaza. Even though most of the media have become stenographers for these terrorists. I think a piece of it is definitely that they have sided with the Palestinians historically, and to admit that you were wrong to do that, that you were actually siding with Hamas, is very difficult. It's very difficult to say my enemies were right.
Hello. Welcome to the Anne and Phelim Scoop with just Anne McElhenney today. I'm all on my own. Phelim has gone to New York for casting and reading and all kinds of things to do with the October 7th play that we are producing, which I want to talk a lot about today. You probably know we talked about the play last week, but the story broke in the media last week, and here you can see the headline from the Daily Mail where the story broke originally, which was great to get it into Daily Mail. We also got a big article in Newsweek. You can see that article there in front of you as well, and even the Santa Monica Observer acknowledged the story, and you'll see all of those. And we're expecting an awful lot of media because this is a huge story. This is one of the biggest projects we've ever done. And I'm going to say this a few times today. Basically, there's three things that we need you to do. And you have been the most incredible people. I mean, we're so grateful for all that you do and all that you've done for us over all these years. We're very, very grateful. But there's three things I need you to do. And everyone can do at least one of them. So the first thing is to share the story. Please share this story with everyone that you know. Share the story of that we were doing this play, that we went to Israel, that we spoke to all these people, these extraordinary, extraordinary people, and that this story that is being buried, that is being forgotten, that is being not reported, will be reported, will be, you know, amplified in this play. And as you know, we're going to film the play and release that online. We're also going to go to Harvard. We're going to bring this play to Harvard, to UPenn, to Princeton, to Berkeley, to all those places that seem to so desperately need an education. Three things we need you to do. Share the story. Tell everyone about it. If you are capable, buy a ticket. If you're in the, as they call it, the tri-state area, or maybe you want to travel to see this play. I just got the most amazing email the other day from one of you, you'll know exactly who you are, who is in Ottawa. And you wrote to tell me that your husband and son will be driving from Ottawa to New York to see the play. 7 hours. I looked it up on the map. And that's, by the way, 7 hours. I imagine it's longer than that if you think about it, because obviously I don't know how long it takes to get across the border. So thank you for that. So that's a challenge for the rest of you, by the way. So if somebody's willing to drive from Ottawa, where are you willing to drive from? And let me know, please. So we need you to share this story. We need you to buy tickets, and then we need you to donate. Please donate to make this possible. This is going to be a very expensive project. Many of you will have probably seen over the weekend that on Easter Sunday, pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian protesters, agitators took over St. Patrick's Cathedral. There's a picture of them there with their, you know, ceasefire now. Ceasefire now when 134 hostages are still being held in Gaza and no one's talking about that. 134 people still held, probably underground in Gaza. Who knows what condition they're in? All kinds of people, young, old, women, children, men and women, unbelievable, from all over the world, including, I don't know, I think the six Americans. I actually don't care about, you know, the fact that, you know, what nationality people are. These are hostages that are not being talked about enough. We need you. So we need you to help us amplify this campaign. You can imagine we're going to be bringing it into the heart of New York. So we imagine they may well be, some protesters might be turning up. So three things: donate, buy tickets, and share this campaign. I'm going to go right now to an amazing interview that we did earlier, that I did earlier, with Batya Ungar-Sahgan from Newsweek. She is absolute delight. You'll be so, so happy to hear from her. She is just extraordinary. And we were so, so happy that she could come on the show. Let's go over to that right now. So we're so happy to be joined now by Batya Ungar-Sahgan, who is an author, journalist, and the deputy editor of Newsweek. I'm going to talk to her about her new book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. But before that, and total honesty here, the main reason I have her on, because I want to talk about Israel. Batya, it's so nice to have you on our show. Hello.
Oh my gosh, Anne, this is such a pleasure, a long time coming. I'm so happy to be here with you. I remember when we first met, you were simply one of the most delightful people I've ever met in my life. We were at a very stodgy conference and you were just so funny and you livened up this space. I mean, from the minute you started talking, I was like, we're going to be friends forever.
I love that. Yeah, instant best friends forever. And then it was really nice. And I was so glad that I was there. As you say, I think they call it a neat meet among the young people now. Is that right? So I'm sorry to kind of interrupt this, you know, very nice meeting with you to sort of ask you to think about October 7th and to ask you, you know, actually to start by saying, like, where were you? Like, where were you on October 7th?
I was in synagogue. It was a holiday. So all of my technology was off. And October 8th was a holiday. And so I didn't find out the real extent of it until October 8th at night. But October 7th, some people in my synagogue who had heard started trickling in and information started to come out. And I remember the first thing we heard was, there's been a terrorist attack in Israel and they're saying that 40 people are dead. And we were in such shock, 40 people dead. How could it be? You know, the days of this we thought were behind us. And it's so amazing to look back at our naivete in that moment because we couldn't imagine. I remember somebody saying they took a female IDF soldier hostage. And I remember we couldn't have thought of something worse. A female IDF soldier, a woman hostage. How can you even imagine? And of course, now we know the extent of it is so much worse. It was just beyond comprehension. And so for the 2 days, you know, we had not accurate information, whatever trickled in. And we were just praying that it wasn't true. And then, of course, October 8th, I turned my phone on, I turned the TV on, and then was basically glued to the TV for the next 3 months. And yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you know, I'm kind of interested, like, because one of the things that's, I mean, this is a huge story, there's so much to say, but I think the personal experience of Jewish people to what happened around them has been extraordinary. Let me put a little personal story into this. I'm a Catholic, not obviously, but I'm Irish, and we'll have to explain that in a moment as well, by the way. But, and you'll find this interesting and not good, but so I was in Ireland on October 7th.
Oh, wow.
And on October 8th, you know, I was out with, you know, meeting different people all over the place. And someone said to me, oh my God, did you hear they turned off the electricity in Gaza? And I made a noise like that. I was like, what? What? You're going to lead with that? You're going to lead with the turn the electricity off in Gaza? This is a nice person who said this to me, by the way, and that shows that, and I want to talk a lot about the media reaction, but can you believe that? That's somebody, you know, who's just, you know, soaking up local media, hearing what's on the radio, whatever, and that's what they led with.
It's so amazing to me. I think Ireland is actually a really good example of how people, when they talk about the Middle East, are actually talking about themselves. I've heard, I don't know if this is true, that there's a street in Belfast and on one side of the street, it's all Palestinian flags. And on the other side of the street, it's all Israeli flags. And it just basically that Irish people project the troubles onto the Middle East. And so if you're a Catholic, you identify with the Palestinians. And if you're Protestant, you identify with Israel. And I think there's definitely educate me if that's not correct. But I think there's a lot of that going on as well in America. You know, these students on college campuses, they don't know squat about the Middle East. They don't know anything. They know that they have immense amounts of white guilt because it's pumped into them like a drug in, you know, from the time they start going to these elite institutions. And as a result, they see Israel as a proxy for American power and for American values. And so they hate it because they hate America.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
kind of my reading.
I mean, were you, I mean, you know, there's so much here, but like, were you shocked by the reaction? I mean, were you shocked by the reaction? Because I'm really shocked. I'm super naive. I did not believe we lived in an anti-Semitic world. I didn't believe that. I didn't know that. If let's say I definitely didn't know that. Did you know the world was that anti-Semitic? Did you know that?
I did. But it, I can't tell you how validating it is to hear that. Like, because there's so much gaslighting going on about it that when someone can see it, it's like we're all walking around like with this feeling of like being gaslit, like, and when somebody just says the truth, like you just did, like Jews feel epidural levels of relief when somebody just acknowledges the truth. It's almost like our shoulders can relax and we're like, okay, you can see it, because there's just so much denial, denial, denial. Yeah, we knew some of us, a lot of progressive Jews didn't, you know, unfortunately, right. About half of the American Jewish community is progressive. And so they sort of were living in this, kind of, you know, it's, I try not to air our dirty laundry in public because I feel like it's, I don't know if it's so good for the Jews, but, you know, they were living, they, a lot of Jews in America are, you know, people often say to me in conservative spaces, why are Jews so liberal? And it's not because they're Jews. It's because Jews are very educated and our university system is basically like a woke mind virus factory. And so they go there and they learn the same things that everybody else does. So, you know, they didn't know that anti-Semitism still exists because they were potentially part of the problem. But, you know, there's been a lot, you know, and it's interesting because there were cases that were very ambiguous where I would be talking to good people, for example, about Jeremy Corbyn. People who I still love close friends who would say to me, he's not anti-Semitic. He just doesn't like Israel because he sides with the underdog and the Palestinians are the underdog. And we would go back and forth about it, you know? And one can have a debate about that. I still love these people, but I hope now it's more clear, like what we were sensing back then was accurate, because of course now it's all come out in the open.
Yeah. And what have you, I mean, have you experienced, I mean, I've heard stories, I mean, I literally didn't know anyone Jewish when I lived in Ireland, because Ireland has about 7 Jews that live in Dublin or whatever. Actually, the community is probably bigger than that, but it certainly wasn't an experience. And then, of course, I come to live in Los Angeles, so I only have Jewish friends now. And we even joke that I've got all of them, by the way. So I've got the really, I've got the real proper ones, right? Right over to the ones that call themselves Jewish, you know, and they make the whole joke about that.
I know, Anne, because you are basically catnip for Jews, because you're smart and you're hilarious and you're very iconoclastic. And that's basically like, that's our DNA right there. And so you're catnip.
I love being catnip, I have to say, to the Jews. Because I'm just, as I said, I've got so many dear friends, but I've heard these really terrible, awful, awful stories, like small stories that are just huge. Like a woman I know, like I don't want to get too specific about anybody, but one woman I know who's lost her best friend, basically.
Aww.
Like her very best friend. I don't mean in October 7th. I mean her best friend here who is saying things that are just, you know, like basically, you know, you deserve it. I know another girl. I know a girl in New York, a very accomplished person, very, very accomplished, who went to Yale. A student who went to Yale with her, like back in the day, and this is a young person in her 40s, whatever. Her friend wrote to her, took time to write to her and say, "What did you expect?" And I mean, I'm right.
So,
I have another friend here who'd be very, very liberal, and she. I mean, she said, she just came out with it recently, and she said, they're going to start rounding us up next. And she said, I'm getting a gun. I'm going to go to the, you know, to the range, and I'm going to make sure I've got my gun skills. And she was, you know, very, very, very liberal Jew. And I'm just like, I mean, and another lady I know, her son who's in his 40s, he lives in Beverly Hills. She said he can't sleep at night. So there's I'm hearing, so I imagine you're hearing an extraordinary number. And I think you also had a little experience yourself of someone spotting your Star of David.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
It was about a week after, and I was in D.C. and I was flying home, and I walked into Dulles, and there was a long line of people who were boarding a flight to Cairo. And I walked in, I wear a very prominent Jewish Star of David, and there was a woman in a hijab and she was surrounded by a big group of men. And when she saw me, probably to impress her, you know, her friends, she yelled at me, "Palestine will be free." And I started to sort of chuckle to myself as I walked to my gate. I was thinking, I mean, not if Egypt has anything to say about it, right? I mean, talk about, like, this is the funny thing is, like, I mean, it's funny, it's ironic, it's horrifying. The Arab countries hate the Palestinians. They won't do anything for them. And so Israel has been charged with the welfare of its enemies when their own people won't do anything for them.
Can you explain that? Can you explain that to me? Because yeah, I mean, I don't understand that.
Well, you know, it's in the West, we like to think that we've invented racism. It's not true. You know, racism, classism, hierarchies, racial hierarchies, ethnic hierarchies exist in every single society. Very little in America these days, which is something of a utopia at this point. But Arab society is incredibly racist. It is incredibly hierarchical. Even within the Palestinian society, the hierarchy is extraordinary. You can't, you know, Hamulas, different families cannot intermarry because they so look down on each other. There's utter contempt for, you know, the Hebronites and the Israeli Arabs who live in Israel and identify with the state, and then for the Gazans and for this clan and that clan. Across the Arab world, they have this very, very, you know, gross view that Palestinians are dirty and lazy and live off the state and that they're terrorists. So if you think about it, like al-Sisi, you should see the wall separating Gaza from Egypt. I mean, it would be the envy of any country. Nobody can get through that wall. He didn't let a single 90-year-old lady through that wall because he is so certain that every single one of them is carrying water for Hamas. Now, maybe he's right. I mean, who knows, right? But certainly Israel is not allowed to have that position. Israel lets people in to work, to get medical care. I mean, so it's so amazing. And the just the BS out there about who is actually responsible for why the aid is not getting there. It's so all of the misinformation. I will say I have to push back on the idea that Jews are physically unsafe in America today. I find that idea extremely offensive. And the reason for that is because, so Ayman Odeh, who's an Israeli Arab politician, he was fond of quoting the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, who used to say that we Palestinians are lucky that our enemies are the Jews, because if they weren't, nobody would care about us, which is so totally true. But I feel like we Jews are lucky that our enemies are like these purple-haired college campus idiots, because they're not actually dangerous. They're all cowards. They're moral cowards. They're physical cowards. They're whiny little you-know-whats. Like, these are not serious, scary people. And yeah, they harass Jews. They discriminate against them. Yeah, we're not in danger. We can handle this. I mean, come on. Like, we're descended from the Maccabees, for God's sake. Like, grow a spine, stand up to these people. You don't have to be popular with them. Yeah, they have contempt for you. That's actually a good thing, because if they were welcoming you in, you'd probably run to join their ranks, as we did for so many years, right? So I really like the idea that Jews are in danger of being rounded up. 80% of Americans back Israel. The vast majority of conservatives are totally on our side. And what's happening is that the Jews bet on the wrong side. And instead of admitting that and saying, we called the side that has our backs white supremacists, they're now saying, oh, they're going to shoot us. Who's going to shoot you? Leftists are scared of guns.
Yeah.
Like, who's going to shoot you? Come on, you know? I think that this is a little bit overblown.
I love that you're descended from the Maccabees. I just love that because, by the way, I mean, I go to, as I said, I'm a Catholic, but I have a very, obviously, it's a lovely, my dearest friends in the world are Jewish, and I get to go quite often to a wonderful Shabbat dinner in Santa Monica with Dennis Prager and Rabbi Michael Gutlib, and just really, really beautiful. And when you come out, we'll go together.
Yes.
And they why am I saying that? Oh, yeah, because when I came back from Israel, so I have never been to Israel. I'd never been to Israel. Of course, I go during a war, you know, but but I came back, and of course, you know, millions and millions of thoughts about all kinds of things, but just on the kind of, you know, on a kind of a sort of superficial, but not really. I said to the guys, I got to the Shabbat dinner. I said, I think maybe you are the chosen people, because the people we met over there, we met every kind, right? We met the very liberal kids who were at the Nova party, whose whole world has collapsed. Their worldview has collapsed because they were all love and we're all the same. Really, fundamentally, we're all the same. you know what? No, not so much. They've learned that. God help them. But they were, and they were extraordinary. I mean, the stories are extraordinary. Yeah. And then we met, like, you know, a guy who drives a truck for Coca-Cola, who just was so amazing and saved so many people. I think 90 people he saved.
Wow.
And he was a bit like you. He said that, you know, he's very, very devout, and he had the television was off, the radio was off, the phone was off, all of that. And then the sirens go off in the morning, and they were different. He said they were different than normal. And he thought, you know what? In this occasion, I'm allowed to turn the television on. So he, in that situation, and he turned the television on, and his first thought was, and I just, oh my God, I love this guy. His first thought was, who is going to save the young people at the party? And it was like, and he knew the answer, you know, and he knew the answer because he had a truck, you know, and there's a photograph. I have a fabulous photograph of him. I'll put it up there actually right now. A fabulous photograph of him driving these kids. And you can see the kids all stuck in behind in the truck. You'll see the photograph on the screen there. And I love what he said. And one of the things that came up with us was, well, anyway, there's so much to say, but the kids that he was saving were obviously of Jewish, you know, they were born Jewish, but they were all atheists, you know, and they start texting their parents going, wow, this guy, like, he's broken Shabbat. And I'm like, and he said that's like how little they know about their religion, that of course you break Shabbat to save a life, you always break Shabbat to save a life. And anyway, he's just one of so many extraordinary people who, I mean, I was blown away by the people I met. I was blown away by the country. And I kind of thought to myself, why wasn't I here before, you know? What an extraordinary place. Oh my God. And what amazing people.
Who's going to go save them? And he knew the answer. Like, that's...
Oh, I could really get you going here. I mean, there was a beautiful girl. I'll tell you one other story. Shani. Oh my God. So gorgeous, of course, like gorgeous. And she has a boyfriend who's gorgeous like that. They're both models, you know, this kind of thing. And we spoke to her for 3 hours, and she was at the party, not with her boyfriend, with three friends. And then, you know, the attack happens, and she starts running with her friends, and people are getting shot dead on each side. And she says to the girl, her friend, the girl, there's two boys and a girl. She said to the girl, I'm going to have to do something. We have to help these people. And the friend said, remember the first rule, you know, remember the first rule of being a medic. Remember the first rule. You have to survive. You're no good to anybody if you don't survive. You know, we have to survive. Mm-hmm. And so they go past, you know, whatever. And they find a place to hide under these thorns. And unbelievable. Again, I'll put up a photograph there, because she took a photograph of one of the boys under the thorns. And the thorns are like, I mean, they're basically, I mean, unbelievable. I've never seen like four or five inches wow. long thorns. So they're underneath that, and they're keeping really, really quiet, you know, but they can hear the Hamas guys are coming on each side, and they can see the pow, pow, and they can see the soil coming up where the shots are being fired. And anyway, it's a very long story, but the one part of it that I just thought was extraordinary was, you know, she was at pains to tell us, you know, I'm not religious, you know, I'm not religious, whatever. And we're like, fine, that's grand, you're not religious. And then she sort of says, you know, but I thought I'll just do the Shema. Is that it, Shema?
Yeah.
I thought I'll just say the Shema anyway, you know. And so she says that beautiful, beautiful prayer. Can you say it there?
Yeah. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad.
And translate it?
Means, hear, O Israel, God is our Lord, God is one.
Yeah. So she said that. And she said, above her head, a little bird landed and looked at her. And she said, I know you think I'm mad. You know, and of course, I didn't think she was mad at all. She said, it was my grandfather. And after she was saved, and it's a really long story, which you will get to see when you come to the play. It's a very beautiful, beautiful story. She was saved. She tells her mother, and by the way, I think my grandfather came in that. And she said, the mother said to her, you know that your grandfather died 10 years ago on October 7th.
Wow.
We had lots of stories like that. And by the way, that girl who, as I said, magnificent, she said at the end of the interview, you know, I'm not really religious, but I'm observing Shabbat now. And then she said, which I thought was so cute, she said, but I'm, you know, I'm not great because I knit, because I need to knit. I find, and I know I'm not meant to knit. And I said to her, look, I'm not a rabbi, but I think you're probably okay with the knitting, you know. Some rabbi now is going to write and tell me that I'm terrible. But basically that she was knitting, you know, kind of as a way to kind of, to deal with her PTSD. But her first instinct once she was saved, her very first instinct was to rejoin her unit, which is a combat medic unit. I mean, But she, and I'm telling you, we had 20 of those stories, and there's 20,000 and 200,000 and more of those stories. The people we met, the whole experience was extraordinary, and this is why we're making the play. And it's just the people's, you know, the play will be just the words of the people who wow. lived through that day and where they were, how it started, how the day started, and what happened to them. And it's
incredible. It's an achievement. What an achievement.
It's what a privilege, actually, by the way. You know what I feel actually that, you know, the use of that word, I hate the use of that word. I really feel privileged that I got to meet these people who I'll never forget. There's a grandmother. Oh my God, I won't tell you her story, but I mean, oh my God, these people are fantastic. Here's a question. What is wrong with Western media that they okay, this is,
they can't quit Hamas, right? They just can't quit them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's two questions. I mean, that's one question. Let's do that first, because I also want to talk about women's groups around the world and all the feminists around the world. But let's start with, you know, maybe succinctly if you can, because I mean, it's a mind virus. What is it?
There's three things happening. Were three explanations, and I believe each of them has like a little piece of the truth, right? The first explanation is they're just f***ing anti-Semites, right? Which is definitely true of some of them. I mean, there were people from the AP at October 7th filming the atrocities, right? Like their offices are like, nothing happens in Gaza that doesn't happen at the pleasure of the butchers. So the idea that there's some independent media, let me tell you something, Anne, this really gets to me. If you want a picture of a Hamas militant off of Getty Images, you have to go back 15 years because they censor every image that comes out of Gaza. So it, by the way, they don't even dress like militants, right? They dress in civilian clothing. So it's structurally built into it. And anybody participating in that is participating in a system that is being run by people who f***ing hate Jews, right? Like, so that's, you know, let's just get that out of the way. But I don't think that's most of it, even though most of the media have become stenographers for these terrorists. So it goes deeper than that. So what else is going on here? I think a piece of it is definitely that they have sided with the Palestinians historically, and to admit that you were wrong to do that, that you were actually siding with Hamas, is very difficult. It's very difficult to say my enemies were right. I know from experience, it's very painful.
Yeah.
But you're supposed, that's journalism. I mean, that's supposed to be journalism.
Yes.
So there's that. And then the third thing, which I think is also at play very much in the women's groups, is that the entire left, the entire, every university educated person has been inculcated into a woke worldview that threw away the distinction between good and evil and replaced it with the distinction between who has more power and who has less power, and then sort of superimposing race onto that. So there's no good versus evil that in an objective sense to these people. There's only who has darker skin as a proxy for who has less power. And abjection itself to them is a form of virtue. In fact, it is the only form of virtue. So the more abject a person is, the less agency they have and the more virtuous they are inherently. So everything they do gets recoded as a virtue, and they have zero responsibilities to act ethically because these people believe that they cannot act at all. They have no agency. Only white people have agency. People have power, who have power, have agency, and they code Jews as white. And so the Jew is inherently evil. The Palestinian, including Hamas, is inherently virtuous. And when something heinous happens between them, like, for example, a Hamas person raping a woman, dismembering her, cutting off her breasts, and driving nails into her vagina, the agency has to be reassigned to the Jew because the Arab cannot have any responsibility for what they do because they are oppressed. That worldview is so embedded in the left. And so whenever they see a Palestinian and a Jew in any interaction, all of the evil and all of the agency belongs to the Jew, no matter what the Arab does. And that includes Hamas. And that's why they side with them again and again and again. And it's just so amazing. They are out here mourning the deaths of mass raping child butchers. Like, it's so crazy. Like, but they can't, to get outside of it, to acknowledge this, to hold Hamas responsible would be to admit that their entire worldview is disgusting. And it's very hard to do that. I mean, most of us are not up to that task. And that, I think that's the explanation that makes most sense to me.
Do you, I mean, you know, it's an awful thing to say, but I mean, is it possible that some good will come out of this? I almost hate the construction of that question, but do you know what I mean?
Where certainly progressive
wing, or it's not even a wing, the progressive half of the Jewish people wake up to some extent. I mean, is that are you seeing some of that? Are you seeing an acknowledgement of their position being inaccurate?
Yeah, it was an amazing thing that happened. We had a wonderful Rorschach test for this, which was the speech of the Oscar winner Jonathan Glazer, who made a Holocaust film based on an amazing book by Martin Amis. I've never seen the film, but the book is unbelievable. I mean, one of the best Holocaust works ever. I in general sort of feel kind of very that fiction about the Holocaust is kind of sketchy, but this book is incredible. I didn't see the movie. I'm very glad now that I didn't. When the director won an Oscar, he went up to accept the speech and he said, "We stand here as Jews who refute our Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked to defend the occupation and what's going on in Gaza, blah, blah, blah." It was such a Rorschach test because all of the bad people were out there defending him, but with a rigor and a vigor that I have very rarely seen before. I mean, I got most of the brunt of it. And all of the Jews were like, "This man is a refutation of Judaism." Like he didn't refute his Jewishness, hijacked, whatever. He refuted standing with the Jews in their time of need. And instead he did what I like to call the move of, "Pick me, Dr. Mengele. I'm one of the good Jews," right? Like that move of begging our enemies to accept him as one of the good ones. Take the bad Jews. Take the Israeli Jews. Take their defenders. Yeah, put them in the line. I'm one of the good ones. Pick me, Dr. Mengele. Pick me, Yehia Sinwar. I'm your good Jew, right? And there was just, I didn't see, the only Jews who were defending him were that teeny tiny minority of like anti-Zionist Jews who are such a minority in our community. But because every anti-Semite wants one in their pocket, they get elevated and they get like a big following, you know, but I really was boiled to see how many Jews were just like, "This man is disgusting."
Yeah. Just unbelievable. I mean, yeah, we were watching, we always do that thing as we watch the Oscars so our audience doesn't have to, and then we talk about it afterwards. But it's like, it's painful to watch, you know, I mean, it really, and we were kind of waiting. I'm watching and thinking it'll be interesting to see what happens here.
And there was very little of it otherwise.
Correct.
I will say,
correct.
I have to say, I think there was a moment of glory to Ireland because when Cillian Murphy got up to get his Best Actor award, I was like, is he going to say something? I mean,
yeah.
I'm sorry, forgive
yeah.
me. I do assume most Irish people are kind of on the side of Palestinians. What he said was, he said, "We're all living in Oppenheimer's world, and I dedicate this to the people seeking peace." And I thought to myself, this is a man who's signing with the Palestinians, but he doesn't have he has enough class to say it in a way that someone like me can hear it and can say, "I respect that about you. I respect how you said that. I respect that as a, I don't know. I thought that he really acquitted himself with a lot of class while not wanting to say nothing. I don't know. That's how I read that. How did you read it?
Well, first of all, I'm incredibly impressed that you can pronounce his name correctly because a lot of Americans think it's Cillian. So yeah, well done on that one. I just kind of, you know, I'm so disappointed and shocked by Ireland. I mean, I really am. But let me tell you something that I think will warm your heart. Oh, I'm really going to kill you with this one. My sister, Catholic, in Ireland, at Christmas, over the Christmas holidays, she put one decoration in her house and it was a Star of David in her front window. So I'm very proud of her for doing that. And I love telling everyone here that she did that. And I just, because I mean, Ireland is mad. It's completely mad. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinarily hostile. I mean, I wouldn't like to be Jewish in Dublin. I mean, it's really frightening. And I mean, shockingly so. I mean, you're saying that you knew about this anti-Semitism. I'm pretty tick. But I think the thing that you said at the beginning, I think it's very, very correct that, you know, the Irish nationalists would side with the Palestinians and kind of identify, you know, that they have a shared identity. I mean, complete madness. I loved the thing. I don't know if you saw the thing in the Wall Street Journal. Brilliant article. I'm sure you did. Where they were writing about, you know, from the river to the sea, and then asking these students who were protesting. Now, can you tell me now the name of that river now? And what sea would that be now? And they genuinely didn't know. And funny, the other thing that I thought was very kind of heartening in a way was when it was pointed out to them and the map was shown to them and it was explained to them, they were like, oh, no, that's not what I want. I don't mean that. You know, so many of them like literally don't understand that they are actually calling for the annihilation of Israel. You know, that's what they're out there protesting and asking for. I mean, extraordinary. Anyway, there's much more to say about all of this, but I want to sort of switch gears and ask you about your book, because your book is about to come out 2nd of April. People can pre-order copies. I'm going to put all of the information in the show notes, and I would really urge people to buy this book because I think it's unbelievably timely. It's so interesting, the premise of the book, because it's exactly what's happening. And the name of the book is Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And it's not just happening in America, by the way. I'm adding that bit because I can tell you in Ireland, I don't know if you know, there was a recent referendum where they tried to take the words mother and woman out of the Constitution, was part of it. And it was resoundingly defeated. Absolutely resoundingly defeated. And all of the politicians were in agreement on getting this constitutional change. So basically the politicians in Ireland are the elite, and they do not represent the people. They represent the, and in Ireland, it's a very big NGO class, a very big class of these non-governmental organizations who are coming up with these policy ideas and hoisting them on this, well, on the government, that are very willing to have anything hoisted on them that sounds progressive. And then the people going, no. No. And the response, by the way, you love this, the response of the media in Ireland and politicians in Ireland to the defeat of these referenda was, the people are stupid. Right. They didn't understand. Right. But tell me more, because your book looks, you talk to individual people who are experiencing this nightmare.
Yeah, I traveled around the country for a year interviewing working class people in all industries, all races, all religious backgrounds, you know, family formations, and to get a sense of, you know, who is the American working class and do they still have a fair shot at the American dream? And they feel acutely the contempt of the ruling class over them. And what I found was astonishing, which is that liberal working class people and conservative working class people by and large agree on it. Almost everything. And whether they vote for Democrats or Republicans, they by and large agree on most issues because neither party represents them. It's a complete crapshoot which one they vote for. And so they don't actually hold it against each other. I mean, that's the real headline of the book, is that sort of polarization is a totally elite phenomenon. We also have a huge NGO class, but it's sort of, you know, 30% of the country has a college education and, you know, 20% are in this sort of top, you know, quintile, which is hoarding the American dream. Hoarding over 50% of the GDP. They have immense privilege. And what they do with that privilege is, you know, in a bygone era, people would have understood, you know, that what you do with that kind of privilege is you thank God for giving you an easy life. And then you have a sense of noblesse oblige, that you owe something to the country, the community that made you so successful and made your life so freaking easy, while there are people cleaning toilets and, you know, I guess in the day farming and working extremely hard. But they don't have that because they're addicted to this sort of meritocratic view where they believe that it was their own merit and hard work that got them this privilege, rather than the economy that they created to reward their easy stay-at-home jobs, right? And working class people know that it's all a scam. They're really angry. They're very upset, but they're still deeply patriotic. And we have abandoned them, and it's not okay. They've been silenced. They've been totally deplatformed because they're socially conservative and the media is completely liberal and woke. And they've just completely abandoned their economic interests. And, you know, even the liberals who are working class, who I interviewed, they would say to me again and again, Trump put money in my pocket. And, you know, that is the thing that the left cannot acknowledge, is that Donald Trump saw these people for who they are. He saw the forgotten American. He saw their struggles. And by the way, all of his ideas for how to help them used to be ideas that the Democrats had. He literally is the pro-labor past of the Democratic Party coming back to haunt it. And so they have to destroy him.
So the book comes out on the 2nd of April.
Yes.
And very exciting. So please, please do buy the book, because I know when we wrote our book, these pre-sales are very, very important. I can't emphasize that enough, because it really, because day one is when, you know, all these lists come out, and it's very, very important. Of course, you know, the New York Times, we've all had that experience. I'm hoping that they are, that their moderators will be honest when it comes to your book, because I'm sure it's going to be a very much, very, very much a bestseller.
Oh,
Batya, we've come to our end of our time, but this has been, oh my God, so, so nice. It's so good to see you. I can't believe I'm going to see you in New York, and I am going to see you in New York. The show opens on the 2nd of May. Perhaps you come on the 2nd of May that night, maybe? Whatever, we'll see.
Gosh.
We'll see. Until the 16th of June, and we've lots and lots of performances. And you know, and we're also respecting, obviously, a lot of Jewish people want to come. So the Saturday shows are going to start at like 9:30, which I think,
amazing.
Yeah. Because we don't want to. And obviously, the show is in a synagogue. It's in the Actors' Temple, which is also operates as a synagogue. So on Friday, we don't have a show, but I think it's a perfect venue. 200 seats, so we need people to buy tickets. So I really hope, that we get a lot of people. And our big plan, by the way, Batya, is that we're going to bring the show to Harvard in the fall, and Princeton, and UPenn, and all those places that need an education.
Amazing.
So yeah. That's the plan. Anyway, thank you so much for your time today. We so appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Anne.
Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you. Can I give you a blessing before we go?
Oh, please.
Yivarech Hashem v'yishmerecha, ye'er Adonai panav eilecha v'ichuneka, yisa Adonai panav eilecha v'yasem lecha shalom. God should protect you and everybody that you love, your sister, your brave sister. And he should bring you a lot of success with this play. You're really doing God's work, and it just, you know, it means a lot. It means a lot.
Thank you very, very much. God bless you. All right. We'll see you soon. Thank you. So Batya's book came out yesterday. Please, please buy a copy of the book. It's called Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And it's already a bestseller, but we would appreciate if you would please go out and buy it, and buy it for somebody else, buy it as a present for somebody. By the way, we won't have a podcast next week. It's Phelan's birthday, and we're taking a few days off. It's been a bit hectic around here lately with everything, organising everything for the play. So it's been very, very busy. So and the next few months are going to be very, very busy. So we decided to take a few days off. So you won't see us next week. But we really want you to come to New York. We want you to bring your friends. You know, one of the things I was thinking about this campaign, it reminds me an awful lot of the campaign that we did for Gosnell. And I want to tell just one story, because one of the things that's amazing about doing these really large projects is that, you know, people turn up. People turn up for us. You have turned up for us so many times. And one story that I love from the Gosnell campaign was, you know, we were raising an enormous amount of money for that campaign. I think we asked for like $2.3 million, the biggest, you know, ask we'd ever made. And, you know, it was very, very nerve wracking. We worked 7 days a week, and we were, you know, hitting the phones, we're asking people, you know, whatever, doing everything. It was really, really crazy. And at one point, Magda came to me and said, there's a woman in Colorado, and she's trying to, you know, she's having problems with PayPal. You know, she's trying to donate $10,000. And I'm like, she's trying to donate $10,000. Give me the phone. So I phoned the lady, Magda, and I talked to her. You know, we talked to PayPal. You know, we did all that sort of stuff. And eventually, you know, whatever the donation comes in, I kind of joked to the woman. I said, look, I'll drive to Colorado, you know, and you can give it to me in fives, you know. But so amazing. And $10,000 was an amazing amount of money. And it was very exciting. Anyway, she's become, and she doesn't mind me saying this, because I know she doesn't mind, because we've become very big friends. So I'm not going to give her whole name. But anyway, Melanie, big shout out to Melanie. But what I loved about what happened with that was, about a few days after the money arrived or whatever, you know, and through PayPal and all of that, Melanie phoned me and said, you know, we really, we this, we that. And I'm thinking, that was what happened with the Gosnell. It became a community. I want October 7th to become a community as well. And it's already becoming a community of extraordinary people, amazing people that are showing up. But Melanie, anyway, we, you know, so she phones and says, you know, we really need to be on the Rush Limbaugh show. And I'm like, right. You know, I didn't know the woman at the time. I'm like, right, you know. She's delusional. You know, you don't get on the Rush Limbaugh show. He didn't at the time. You know, he was famous for not doing interviews. And, you know, and then she, and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, God, that'd be great. That'd be lovely, you know. And then she said, well, I know a guy who knows a guy who knows Mr. Schnerdley. You'll remember Mr. Schnerdley was the producer, was one of the producers for Rush Limbaugh. And whose name is James Golden, by the way. His real name is James Golden, but Rush Limbaugh called him Mr. Schnerdley. Anyway, this woman, Melanie, sent me an email address. And I got an email address for Mr. Schnerdley, for James Golden. And I wrote to him. And I, no lie, absolutely no lie, I would say within less than 5 minutes, I got a response. And he kind of wrote really like almost conversation. He was like, you know, that this looks good or whatever, you know, but who are you? Like, who are you? And I kind of thought, God, how do I describe who I am? And I wrote back and I said, I thought maybe, you know, the last big thing we had done was Frack Nation. And I wrote, you know, I wrote back. I went, well, we made a documentary about fracking called Frack Nation. It's on the television. And he wrote back in all caps, we love you. We're going to get you on the show. I tell no lie. And he then, you know, he then said, give me your telephone number. He phoned me. And James Golden is a friend of mine. What a lovely man. But basically, he then said, you know, as you know, Rush does not do interviews himself, but he has guest hosts and they do interviews. And I think it was Eric Erickson, who at the time used to sit in for Rush occasionally. And Eric Erickson interviewed me. And I was on the radio, I think, for maybe 20 or 30 minutes. And within that time, I think $280,000 came in. The computer nearly melted in front of me, you know. And I remember he phoned me afterwards. James phoned me afterwards and he said, you know, a lot of conservatives are very scared. You know, this is a while back, obviously. You know, they're really, you know, they're suspicious of the internet. You know, some people have phoned already asking, like, is there another way that they can donate? And I'm like, yeah, you can always send a check. And actually, talking of which, I will put up the address where you can send checks to if anyone wants to send a check. But I just love that story. You know, we're coming to the end of this show. I mean, I'm so pleased we had Batya. I mean, what an extraordinary interview that was. But, you know, please, please do the three things that we need you to do. Please share the story of the October 7th play. There are about, I think there's 13 characters that will be on stage, and they are all people who we met in Israel. The most extraordinary people with the most extraordinary stories of how they survived, what they witnessed on that day, on October 7th. They are so powerful. I'm so excited to share this with you. And for those of you who think, okay, well, I can't go to New York, don't worry, because we're filming it. We're going to have a film crew go. We're going to film it and release it so the whole world get to see and hear these extraordinary stories. So again, three things that you can do. Share this story. Please donate. And please buy tickets and get people that you know to buy tickets. The theatre is bigger than what we're used to. I think there's a total of 200 seats and we have a lot of performances. The very first performance, the first preview is on May 2nd. The last performance is on the 16th of June. And I can, you know, on the link, if you go to October7theplay.com, October7theplay.com and click on tickets, it'll bring you to the calendar of all of the dates that we have. And you can also go to and on the same place on unreported on exactly the same place you'll see on octobertheseventhplay.com octobertheseventhplay.com you'll see a link also to donate, and that'll bring you directly to the Unreported Story Society donation page where you can donate. And we are a 501c3. All donations are tax deductible. That's it for this week. We won't see you next week. Please, please do these three things. Please share the story. Please donate. And please buy tickets. Thank you so much. And the next time you see us, we'll be Phelim and I after our holiday. Thank you.